Martin Bloomfield, or should that be Martin Dottyshoes, is my guest this week in my latest nostalgia interview. Martin is studying towards a PhD in philosophy at the University of York, and I knew him many years ago when we both lived and studied in Lampeter. Martin tells us about how Lampeter was a collection of caricatures, and he also talks about how he went to a number of different schools, including an upper middle class prep school, then on to grammar school, and he remembers from childhood the birth of his younger brother, and he reflects on how York, and himself for that matter, have changed over the years. Martin talks about how he ended up in Lampeter, how he was so immersed in it he didn't want to leave, and he tells us what the most valuable lesson that he learned in Lampeter was and how it went on to inform the rest of his life. We learn that Martin would go and see gigs at Gassy Jack's in Cardiff, including Bad Manners, and the perhaps C-list musicians who would come to Lampeter, and he'd go to different branches of a karate club, and we talk about what it is like to go back and why he considers Lampeter to be very much like a person. Martin talks about his involvement in the fencing society, the infamous foot joke, which he doesn't actually tell us, and how going to university helped him to discover who he was. Martin tells us how he did and did not stand for Parliament for the Not on the Ballot Paper Party. We talk about how politics has changed over the decades, why he is a classic floating voter, and why he has found the last few elections to be extraordinarily depressing. We talk about the role of radio in growing up, how the charts don't matter so much anymore, how he remembers listening to Mark and Lard at the height of Britpop, the time when Radio 1 didn't play Status Quo, and Simon Bates and Our Tune, and how young people were no longer connecting with Radio 1. Martin says why he chooses the sweet over the bitter, how he was tested quite late for dyslexia, how school days weren't as good as his university days, how happiness is not just about smiling, and at the very end of the interview, Martin talks quite candidly and revealingly about how his younger self wouldn't recognise what he is doing now, and what advice he would now give his 15-year-old self. And at the end, Martin tells us why he has a synchronic view of time. So what an absolute pleasure to catch up in Scarborough in the summer of 2019 with Martin Bloomfield for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure. I've come all the way up to Scarborough to meet Martin Bloomfield. I was about to say Dottyshoes for a minute, but yeah. I can't help myself.
I lived for basically most of my time in Lampeter under the pseudonym Dottyshoes, to the point where I was getting letters addressed to Martin D.S. Bloomfield.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a strange sort of nomenclature I had. Yeah.
But it's great to have that sort of reputation there, because it also means not just on social media, but like decades later, this mythical creature who paraded the streets of Lampeter in the early to mid-1990s and now might be parading the streets of North Yorkshire again, does exist.
I made a special effort. I went to the Lampeter reunion last year, made a special effort, brought my black and white shoes, and people recognised the shoes. So it was nice to do that, yeah.
Yeah, so and I think also Lampeter, my sense with Lampeter as well, is that it's the sort of place where in any other university people might blend in. It's almost like in every school there's one person who's made for somewhere like Lampeter, but then you put everybody who's made from all of those schools into one place, and suddenly it's like we're all the same. Sense of community.
Yeah, it was like a collection of, and I don't mean this in a negative way, it was a collection of caricatures.
Yeah.
And I think the more conscious you were of that caricature that you had, the more you enjoyed it. So
if you left and you didn't have a nickname, then you sort of knew that you made a mistake on UCAS all those years ago. No. So and you're from Yorkshire, is that right?
I'm from York. Yeah.
And tell me a bit about your background and sort of obviously you've just told me where you were from, but something about growing up in York, and I'm guessing like me, the sort of like latter part of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, I was born in 69. My God, you know. But I grew up in York, and I grew up in a sort of a socially sort of roller coastery sort of family. That my dad had a job when I was a kid, and that was quite posh. and we had a reasonably comfortable life, and I was sent to York Minster Song School. Ooh. As a scholar, I got in with some form of scholarship or something. But so I had a very very normal primary school child, and then an upper middle class sort of prep school, and then couldn't afford to go on. I wasn't going to pass any of the exams to get to public school. Couldn't afford the fees anyway, so I went to grammar school, and that then became a comprehensive school. And so I sort of went through all the all the score systems and never really fitted into any of them.
Yeah. But so in terms of things like earliest memories, what really stands out from that period?
From school time?
Or indeed really young childhood?
Well, I've got some very early memories. I've got early memories of bonfire night, and I must have been about three. I know that I have memories from before I was three. I know that because my younger brother is 3 years almost to the day younger than me. I'm 24th of October, he's 23rd of October. And I remember very clearly my mum going into hospital and my mum and dad preparing for my mum to go into hospital for the birth of my younger brother. And my older brother talking about dad making chicken pie or something. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I have very clear memories from just before my younger brother was born and playing football in the little garden outside my mum's maternity ward window. So, I've got memories from that.
Yeah, you know, Charles, it's really funny with maternity wards because I've got children who are all sort of like 18 months between each other. And of course, bringing children into maternity units is... on the one hand inevitable, but also just a recipe for chaos.
Yeah,
because if you haven't got like the children who are just like, you know, 12 hours old and that's sort of enough of a responsibility, but then you've got the 2-year-olds who say, I know, let's see if we can run from one end of the ward to the other in like, you know, 5 seconds.
And I would have been one of those. I still would be if I'm honest with you.
So that sounds like a traumatic memory.
I mean, it was fine. I mean, I remember it very well. I do remember that hospital's now closed and it became, you know, the old neighbour Hospital, it was called, I think, and it's now that the shopping centre there or something, so that's all gone.
And when you go back, I mean, is it, because obviously you're living in the same part of the world that you, where you grew up, but do you sort of notice any real changes in that time?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know what happened. On the one hand, it could be that York's changed a lot, and on the other hand, it could be that I've changed a lot, but probably more closely to the truth, we've both changed a lot. I mean, I remember York was an industrial city, believe it or not. Most people don't realise that. It had like glass factory, it had a couple of chocolate factories, it had carriage works, it had a few factories, sugar beet factory, and they all closed down. And I remember in the late 80s, I think it would have been, that the city fathers, whatever you'd call them, started trying to transform York into more of a service industry tourist spot. And a lot of us hated it, because we felt like we were living in a museum. But what it did is it brought tourists in, which brought money in, which brought a bit of culture, which brought more business in, which brought more tourists in, and it became a virtuous circle. And York's now a really great place to live. Yeah. It's got a lot of life. I mean, say I'm now in my late 40s, and the live music scene in the city, there's live music free every night of the week. There's arts projects going on all over the place. There's classical music, there's jazz. I mean, it's a really, really vibrant place to live now.
Yeah, and you find that when you go, I was in Chester a few days ago, and if you go to places like Bath as well, you know, there's some really good cultural, you know, places. But if you live there, Canterbury, you know, has a lot of that. But of course, you kind of take it for granted sometimes if you're living there. And I think it's only when people say, oh, you know, I always go to the Marlowe Theatre, or, you know, somebody who used to be at Lampeter in the 1960s said, tell me about the art scene in Canterbury, because I'm thinking of moving there. And of course you just think, oh, but you realise that when you sort of go through the list, you think, well, actually, we have a pantomime every year, and actually it's something that growing up in Cardiff, it's only when I actually moved to Lampeter that people would say to me, oh, you're so lucky living in the city. And of course you've never known anything else, you take it for granted.
Well, part of my job is working with foreign business people and foreign teachers and foreign organisations, and they come to York for 1 week, 2 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, and I've got to show them a good time in the evenings, whatever that sounds like, you know. I've got to entertain them in the evenings.
Is this your evening off?
Well, funnily enough, it is, and most Tuesdays I would. So, and it's kind of my job to know where to go and where to take people. So at the moment, there's the pop-up roast theatre. There's a Shakespeare roast theatre project in the city. And then there's the Van Gogh immersive experience. And it's very nice indeed.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're either very well trained, or you just sort of, you yourself are so immersed in the culture of York that you just, it's all second nature to you.
I fell in love with it when I moved back. In fact, I fell in love with it. I was, I'd just come back from living in Australia. And I stayed with my mum, who still lives in York, just looking for somewhere to stay and somewhere to live, and maybe trying to get a job in London. Mm. And I just fell in love with York, so I thought, this is the place to be.
Yeah, and it's often one of the hardest things as well, because when you've had, but you obviously, well, you went a lot further than I did to university, because Lampeter is not that far from Cardiff, although culturally it does feel very different, and linguistically as well, because obviously I learned Welsh at school, but I moved to Welsh and thought, no one spoke it in the way that I was taught it, very BBC Welsh. But in your case, and a lot of Lampeter students were from the northeast, you know, those around the Durham, Middlesbrough area. Yeah. But for me, it was as though I'd come of age. It was a rites of passage, but it was almost as though I didn't want to do what Dorothy does, you know, in The Wizard of Oz, which is to return home. Mm. You have to, ultimately, it's like, well, you know, it's like going on holiday. There's a point where you say, you know, you can have a really long holiday, but you have to ultimately say, well, that's it. Shirley Valentine, I guess, is the sort of inversion of that, because she doesn't leave. But I think I spent 10 years in Lampeter. It was almost as though I stretched the elastic to the breaking point.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
But then I had to, but I didn't go home to Cardiff, but I did move, eventually in my 30s to Kent.
Yeah, I mean, there was a talk given to sixth form college students. I mean, I dropped out of, dropped out of education, went back in, failed my O-levels, scraped a couple of A-levels. I was a couple of years behind other people. And I went to a talk on the kinds of universities you should apply to. And I wasn't going to apply to a university. I was, struggling with sort of general studies A-level. And I remember at one point they said, what you need to do is find a university that's far enough away that your parents can't visit you every weekend, but close enough that you can take your washing home every so often. Yeah. And Lampeter was not that. Lampeter was a place where it took a good 12 hours to get to from York.
Yeah.
And one of the great things about it is that by the end of it, I refused to leave. I stayed there during the holidays. Mm. I wouldn't go. I wouldn't, half the time, I wouldn't even leave Lampeter, because I wanted to be immersed in it so much. Because it was a place where, for me, if I wasn't immersed in it, maybe the bubble would burst.
And I think also you find that when you move to a place, when you're younger, you've got no choice in the matter. Yeah. Your parents decide which school you go to. And, some of my own students or people I've met along the way will often say, I did A-level so-and-so because my parents thought it would be good for me. So, I'd have a career in computing or whatever it might be afterwards, which, may be at odds with what they really wanted to do. But in my case, going to university, it's almost as though at the age of 18, I started living. It's almost like that was the button, because suddenly it was, well, I made this decision. And up to that point, I had, even as you mentioned about having your clothes washed, but, I didn't even know what a washing machine looked like, really, or not as well. And, I never cooked for me. Although, actually, my mum was, everything was sort of hand-washed and put on the line. But it's funny, because suddenly it was a case of, well, what do you do now? You have to, I suppose there probably are books you can read, like Grant on the Grub was one of them. But it's something that when you learn those sort of skills, you without realising, I think even almost 30 years on since I first went to Lampeter, I kind of feel that those skills have come in very handy, because you sort of find yourself, well, this, you have to make that decision. You can't say to someone, help. Well, you can, but sometimes it's like, well, you have to make a decision. This is your evening. The evening will go the way that you want it to, but do it responsibly.
I mean, interestingly, you say those skills you learn in Lampeter come in handy. The one thing I think that I learned of the most value in Lampeter, the most valuable thing I learned in Lampeter, apart from any of the things I was given in lectures, was that there's a wide world out there. And because it was such a small place, you mingled with the foreign students a lot. And that sort of cultural competence, I mean, it was very sort of early stages for that. It informed the rest of my life. I left Lampeter, went to live in Germany. I went to live in Switzerland after that, Peru. And I work with foreigners now. And it gave me that hunger for a foreign culture.
And I think that was the thing that really stood out for me, that I might be in a very far-flung part of Wales without a railway line, but there was one evening particularly, and admittedly it might have been like an international students evening. Well, it might have been international students evening, But generally, one person I would be from Germany, the next person from Hong Kong, the next person from Australia, and suddenly I'd think everyone I've spoken to has been from somewhere other than the United Kingdom. And it was that sort of a place, although, sometimes of an evening, because I at one point was living in the centre of town, you'd see a very different sort of culture.
But by
day, it was hugely international, especially from the Middle East, from China.
Yeah.
And I thought nowhere else within such a small space would have such an eclectic mix of nationalities.
And because it was a small space, you really noticed it. And the Welsh was a nationality. The Welsh were a nationality there, very much so. In the very much a sort of a Welsh nationalist nationality, and it was. And it was noticeable, and it was great. You know, there was occasionally, there was a little bit of sort of discomfort, but in general, you got to immerse yourself in that, and especially if you lived there for the holidays.
Yeah. No. For me, and also the concept of going home was an absolute anathema.
Yeah.
Because as you say, in a way, you sort of got more work done while also relaxing, because you could set the pace for yourself. And so in the holiday, people would visit often and be like, oh, we'll go down the bar tonight. But you think, right, that gives me 4 hours to get on with that assessed essay or something. And it kind of just reinforced that. So it was the right sort of balance, I think. Yeah. But for me, music, the charts, growing up to the point of obsession. And it's never left me. I'm not interested in the charts now, but the charts then, when I listen to Pick of the Pops on the Saturday, I'm as excited now, to see what is number one, even though it was number one 30 years ago, as I am now. Did you have any similar sort of interest? Was music a big part of your growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the few times, the few times I left Lambert often was to go to see gigs in Swansea or Cardiff. I mean, I don't know if you remember a place called Gassy Jack's in Cardiff.
Ooh.
Gassy Jack's. I don't know if anyone's listened to this who remembers Gassy Jack's. It was a fantastic sort of Americana sort of place which had live music. Yeah. I saw Bad Manners for the first time. I saw them in Gassy Jack's. Yeah. I saw a good few bands in Gassy Jack's, actually. It's a really good place. You'd go to Cardiff, you'd have a couple of beers, you'd do what you did, and then you went to this horrendous, grotty place. Yeah. But it was just wonderful.
Yeah.
So yeah, I went there. I went to Cardiff, St. David's Hall in Cardiff as well, wasn't it? Couple of places in Swansea and I'd see bands. And
you saw lots of comedians after there as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I did a couple of comedians, yeah. Although, if I'm honest, I can't remember that many. I think I saw Charlie Chuck once.
Julian Clary?
No, I didn't. I never did.
But it's funny, isn't it? Because for me, so many things were mediated through radio. And like with film, I think it was only really at university that I thought, let me see what, we'd hear the soundtrack to a particular film, but actually going to see that film was something that I just didn't do when I was young. I don't know why, because my school friends were always going to see Indiana Jones or Ghostbusters Back to the Future. But so again, at university, it was almost like suddenly everything, fitted together. It was almost as though I sort of had the skeleton in front of the map in front of me, but now it was a case of not just having the map in front of you, but actually, going to those places and being directed by the map. And I think that in that sense, it was a more well-rounded experience. But gigs, I never really did until the last few years, when so many artists now do the, since it is the nostalgia tour, I've seen 10cc and I've seen Hall & Oates. And I'm definitely more of a cinema person, but going to see those acts live, there is something almost of, your own childhood as a sense of connection. It's like, this really happened, and this is my link to the past.
And the bands we got at Lambeter were not big bands. I mean, we had Doctor and the Medics a few times, and we had Mike Fabgear and the Permissive Society. You remember that, don't you?
Now you mention it. Yes, that was in the recesses somewhere of my mind. Yeah.
No way, sis. I mean, it really was sort of C, D-list musicians that we got. And so, if you get the chance to see the bands now, you jump at it. Yeah. Because in those days, it was simply sitting by the radio with a tape cassette.
Absolutely. And I remember, and of course, Crazy World of Arthur Brown, I think.
Yeah.
And I think you told me that he... Because we were sort of saying, well, he had this hit in 1968, and then in something like 99 or 2000, he appeared in the Union Bar of an evening. Like, what has he done in the last 30-odd years? And someone said, he did a degree in philosophy. I'd like to think maybe he did a few other things, although,
It takes us quite a long time. It took me 4 years. I was there for 7.5 years in Lambeter. So, it takes a while.
Yeah. And of course, Lambeter had some homegrown bands as well. In fact, I was at the reunion this year, just a few weeks ago, and Edmund Estefan, I don't know if you remember, and the Madroilean Sound Machine. He gave the guest talk.
And there was a few, but to be honest with you, I struggle to remember the names. When people mention the names, I remember them, but I don't really.
And so to this day, I mean, do you kind of, you mentioned bad manners, but there must be a sense in which, having gone to see all these artists, or, you know, the Lampeter Association is a small town, but somehow it didn't feel to me all that isolated, because in a way it was, you know, if you wanted to get on the bus, it was more of a commitment. That's maybe the point. It's rather than the easy sort of, oh, we'll just stroll into the local club, you had to make the effort, and it was all the more special for it, but you had to book in advance, maybe book the minibus or the Transcumbria or get the train. And somehow those journeys, or, you know, going to the Arts Centre in Aberystwyth, felt all the more special because I remember the journey there in the minibus, and even to this day, the conversations in the minibus, because normally if you go on the train, you're just with lots of anonymous, you know, with strangers, but suddenly all of these like-minded people going to see the same Arts Hall gig.
It was great, and the Arts Hall gigs were great. The film showings in the Arts Hall, Warpsock film showings, and you say leaving Lambeter, the idea of going from Lambeter to one of the nearby towns for me was the journey in itself. I mean, I used to hitchhike from one place to another, or I remember once a guy called Joe Davey and I, we set off from Lambeter and walked to Aberystwyth, and he walked to Carmarthen at some point. And, you know, it's not that far. It's like 20 miles or something like that. Maybe not even 20 miles, I don't know. But it's such a great thing to do on an evening. And yeah, why not? It's beautiful countryside, and you enjoy the journey. And when you get there, I mean, I used to go to a karate club then. Yeah. And it was kind of a federal karate club. So there was one in Lambeter, one in Aberiron, one in Aberystwyth, one in Carmarthen. And you go to all these different branches of the same karate club, meet the same people, and form like a community that's spread out beyond Lambeter's reaches.
And I'm guessing that those same friends you're still in touch with today.
Many of them, many of them.
Yeah, and I think that Lambeter had, there was something in that, and I found that because I was offline in for many reasons for a number of years, and then I then came back with a vengeance, and I was like, I'm making up for lost time, Martin. You said, you know, don't worry, I'm I didn't go to the cinema when I was young. You know, I made up for it in later years, so I'm a late starter. But what I did find is that in meeting friends in, for example, Cardiff, who were based in Lampeter, suddenly we were picking up conversations from where we'd left off 25 years ago. And it really struck me that it's really about the people rather than just the place.
Yeah, and those conversations aren't stale. They're not sort of old conversations where you've got nothing to talk about. Yeah. They're actually quite modern conversations. They're just that you're picking up again. Yeah,
and for that reason, sometimes when you do go back to a place, the first thing you think of, oh, it's very different. And, you know, that's what people are saying at the moment. You know, oh, it's not like it used to be. But, of course, in a way, it shouldn't be like it used to be, because nowhere else is going to be like that. But, of course, I think a small town, well, Lampeter is a very obvious case in point, because of its size, there is a sense in which, within a very small radius, there are so many generations of memories of places and particular buildings that have been, you know, well established, and which will never be, you know, razed to the ground. They're listed buildings, and I think for that reason, people, you know, have far more respect for the institutions of the place.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I mean, I've been back to Lambeter twice now, and the first time was a very weird experience. I'd sworn, after I'd been there for about 7.5 years, and I swore I would never go back. Yeah. Not because I didn't want to go back, not because I didn't like it, but because I thought, now that chapter's over, I can now move on, and I won't go back. Yeah. But I had a friend called Hector. I don't know if you remember Hector, Hong Kong guy. I'm still in touch with him, still talking to him now. He's involved in the protests against the government and the triads, and it was his birthday party. And he'd gone back to Lambeter to have his birthday, and I thought, well, I can't say no. He's come all the way from Hong Kong. So I went, and it was a very weird experience. It was like meeting an ex-girlfriend whom I still found very, very beautiful, but had nothing in common with anymore. Yeah. And it was a very odd, sort of alienating experience the first time I went back. Went back again last year and was in a better frame of mind and absolutely adored it.
And I think also, because when you went back, coincidentally, there was the official Lambeter Society reunion taking place.
Yeah.
And so that's how I met you. In fact, I think I just arrived and I checked Facebook and you said, I don't know if you knew there was a reunion taking place before you got there, and I think you were at the Falkendale Lake, and it was like, well, Martin, you've got to come down. And you only went to the talk that I gave. And that was, and I think that's what made it special. It was people who this year stayed an extra night, rather than leave when everyone else did after lunch on the Sunday, then we're saying the next morning, I'm sitting on my own in this coffee shop. Everyone, the gang's gone. It feels very lonely here. Yeah. I'm glad first of all, I thought it's a long way to come just for two nights. You know, barely, it's not even 48 hours. Yeah. But actually, I think that was enough. Any longer than that, I think it would have. It's like, if you go back, I think it's, you know, whereas once I went and never left, in going back, you know that you can keep doing that year in, year out, but you know you must leave after a designated time.
Exactly.
The mistake is thinking this is a long-term thing, because then you'll be bitterly disappointed, because you say, but there's no one here anymore. And you can make new friends, but it's kind of been there, done that.
Yeah, absolutely. When I went back last time, I was with my girlfriend, and I wanted to introduce her to Lambertus in a way that I'd understood Lambertus, in a way that I'd experienced Lambertus. And to me, Lambertus was like a person. You don't know Lambertus by saying, oh, I recognise this building, I recognise this building, I recognise this building. You kind of interact with the place.
Yeah.
And I remember, I got a little frustrated because she didn't seem to enjoy the aimless long walks in the way that I did. Yeah. But by the end of it, she was walking the pipe, and she was helping me move a Porter's Lodge sign from one place to another, and all the silly things of Easter. And she seemed to connect and experience it in a similar way, that I'd kind of hoped that she would.
Yeah. No, it does weave its magic, or if it's not going to, it never will. Mm. If it hasn't woven its magic after a couple of weeks, it's never going to.
Yeah.
I think that's what makes it very sort of special. But what about other things that were going on when you were at university in terms of, you mentioned karate, for example, but any other sort of undercurrents, anything, politics, religion, sport, film, music, anything that really stands out from those years?
Well, I was, I remember when I went, I was known as three things, really. And first of all was the guy, some people called me Spatsman, some people called me Dodgy Shoes, the guy with the black and white shoes. I was probably most instantly recognisable as the guy in the black and white shoes. The second thing I remember was that I was the guy, or people knew me for, was the guy who fenced. So I was the fellow from the fencing society. And I don't know how true this is, but I like to think that I took a very sort of, and I don't mean this in a negative way, very sort of unorganized, not disorganized, but unorganized sort of baby steps fencing club, and sort of brought it into a modern sort of a modern fencing world. Mm. We went to competitions and sort of got places in competitions, and we formed a real sort of a real society that had a place in Lambertus. And the third thing was I was the guy who told this joke. Now I'm not going to tell it to you now, but there was a joke I told called the foot joke. Mm. And everybody knew it, and I was it was quite a long joke, and enough people kept coming up to me saying, Martin, will you tell the foot joke? Or Dodgy, who's tell the foot joke? And after a while, I got really sort of irked by this, and I thought, well, if they're going to use me like a joke machine, I'm going to treat myself like a joke machine. Yeah. And someone came up to me and said, will you tell the joke? And I went, okay, I'll tell it if you pay me.
Yeah.
And then she said, well, how much? And I was completely taken aback by that. I went, 10p.
Yeah.
And she went, okay, she gave me 10p. I started telling the joke. Then halfway through, she gave me another 10p to stop. So I think those three things, first of all, but also, more than anything else, it was my discovery of myself, who I was. Before that, I'd lived a very a very staid, rather conservative sort of teenage sort of years. I hadn't gone out and done the sex, drugs and rock and roll thing like a lot of teenagers had, certainly in York. And I hadn't really found myself. I was still, I was 22 when I went to university. Mm. I was still living with my parents at the time. Mm. Didn't have a job, didn't have a hope for a job, couldn't hold down anything that I got. And so going to Lambertus allowed me to discover who I was, and that was a very important thing.
Yeah. No, and I think for a lot of people, it's what you then do. I mean, friends of mine who went back living with their parents, I thought I couldn't do that on principle. That for me would be a retrograde step.
Yeah.
But am I imagining it, or did you once stand for Parliament?
I did, many years ago. Kind of, well, I sort of yes and no, I did and I didn't. I stood for Parliament on the idea that I wanted to make York an independent nation state and become king. And this was, it was a joke thing. Yeah. But it got to the point where you had to then put your money where your mouth was and become serious. And it cost, I know what it was, £1,000 or something to slap down a deposit. And I knew I wasn't going to get any votes. And so I rebranded my party, the Not on the Ballot Paper Party, and sort of became quite loud, I suppose, in York as a voice against politics. Because at the time, I think 1992 this was, it was John Major versus
Kinnock, wasn't it?
John Major versus Kinnock. And to be honest with you, neither of those two choices was a particularly striking choice. And neither of those two choices would have been a great prime minister. And John Major, you can argue, wasn't a great prime minister. Yeah. I don't think anyone could argue that he was a great prime minister. Yeah. And so, yeah, I stood out as like the voice of anti-politics, almost of none of the above. And of course, as a joke, you know, I noticed at the end that the number of people who hadn't voted was actually greater than the number of people who voted for the Liberal Democrats, who wanted a form of proportional representation. Yeah. So I argued that I should have more seats in Parliament.
Well, it's funny you say that, because at the time, politics always, you know, and certainly go back to the 70s. I mean, who was that famous comedian? Mike Yarwood, who did brilliant impressions of all the days of the day. But ultimately, although he could do the same, you know, he could do Callaghan, he could do Wilson, he could do Heath. Really, ultimately, but between them, they were all kind of centre-ground politicians. Yeah. And the 92 election, as you say, was kind of a battle for different parts of the centre. But one thing that you've sort of seen now is that, you know, politicians who do take those kind of risks, who in some cases come out of nowhere rather than being established parties, can win seats. I mean, obviously, absolutely, we see it now, not least in the light of what's going on.
Well, we see Boris Johnson now. We see, you know, on the other hand, I would argue that Jeremy Corbyn is very, very similar. Mm. The idea that, you know, a lot of these people are arguing to your heart rather than your head, regardless of which one you agree with. They're both kind of speaking to the same limbic part of the brain rather than the sort of cortex. Yeah.
But something about that works for good or ill, because certainly I remember the 2010 election. I was using a political analogy in the classroom with my students and mentioning, oh, of course, it's the election next Thursday. And I didn't really get the sense that anybody was particularly excited. I mean, it's not for me to guess whether people, the students, really voted, but it didn't seem to be the most sort of, they didn't seem to be super, super passionate. Fast forward to 2017, and I saw in The Guardian online that there was a big queue outside the polling. I didn't know there was a polling station, but right on campus. So I thought, well, I'm going to walk past it just to see for myself. And there they were. Mm. And Labour won Canterbury for the first time in its 100-year history. Mm. So something has changed in those years. Mm. And so in a way, it's sort of like, well, be careful what you wish for. Because, you know, I mean, 1992, do you remember it was the Natural Law Party?
I do remember the Natural Law Party. Yeah. Oh, God, there's some transcendental meditation in there.
And what was funny then is because if a party was fielding enough candidates, they would get a party political broadcast. Yeah. But of course, because they were, you know, because they want to appeal to the floating voters, that was good. But of course, they were entitled to their 5 minutes of fame. And I think, and I have a feeling that David Owen was as well, because although the SDP weren't standing, the SDP had seats in the parliament up until 92. It's like the SDP had been disbanded or had merged with the Lib Dems, and then suddenly he was like, well, you know, I've got these 5 minutes, and we were all waiting to see, is he going to endorse Labour, is he going to endorse the Conservatives? And he was just really saying, this is what I think, but you know, don't vote for me because I'm not on the ballot paper. But those were looking back, these were crazy times.
Days, I mean, you do get, I mean, I'm not I am a classic floating voter. I voted, you know, I'm quite happy to state that if you look at the Liberal Democrats, the Labour Party, the Conservative Party and the Green Party, I voted for each one of them at least once in the past sort of six elections or something. And I'm quite happy to do that. I'm quite happy to vote where I think the vote should go rather than vote along party lines. For somebody who found voting for, I mean, I don't mean to offend anybody, but for somebody who found voting for Theresa May impossible, and somebody who found voting for Jeremy Corbyn impossible, and for somebody who also found voting for the Liberal Democrats this time around impossible, I found the last couple of general elections extraordinarily depressing. Mm. Without having a political party to vote for, without wanting to vote for a particular issue, I found it extremely depressing at a general election, sitting down thinking, well, what am I going to do? Mm. I want to contribute, but I've got a problem here.
Yeah. No, I remember I think it was the 2015 election, and I had been following the debate rigorously, but I knew that I wasn't particularly enamoured with any of the leaders, and they all carried baggage, especially as we had a coalition government. Mm. So two of the parties were already sort of implicated at the time. So all that was interesting. But in the end, I voted Lib Dem in that election. But then I wasn't sure that Ed Miliband really sort of had what it took to be Prime Minister. But what I remember is going to the ballot box and thinking, and what the funny thing was, I hadn't even looked to see who the candidates were, but I was following the national debate more than the local one. And of course, they tell you where the candidates live. You know, they give the address.
Yeah.
And I was just about, and I voted Lib Dem. Then I realised that the address was somewhere, it was something like in Belgium. And I thought, so even the candidate knew that he or she was not going to win that seat. And indeed, that, you know, the Dems were never realistically going to win that seat in Thanet. But it's almost as though, you know, when I was younger, everybody voted the way that their parents did. You know, in the 92 election in Lambeth, a lot of the students were not interested, but there was a clear sense that if they had to vote, they would vote along the sort of family lines. Mm. And I don't see that happening anymore.
No, it happens an awful lot less. I mean, you find you vote along social media bubble lines. That's where the lines are now drawn, that you get drawn into a social media bubble, and this is the kind of political stance you have to take. And on that, you know, on that, I mean, I don't mean to bring the B word up. You know, I've got friends on both sides of the Brexit debate, and I understand both particular arguments.
Yeah.
And yet, even though I'd like to say I understand the arguments of the Remain and the Leave side, the things that people are saying online are sort of ridiculous and extreme on both sides. And it's quite an interesting thing to see that,
No, it was once upon a time, if you wanted to know what was in the news, if you wanted to know what people were thinking, you'd watch the 6 o'clock news or read teletext, you know. But now, it was when Trump was elected in 2016, I said to one of my PhD students, who's from North Africa, I said, she said, gosh, I wasn't expecting that. And I said, so, you know, where were you, you know, when you found out? Because we you know, a lot of us were like, oh, you know, I woke up in the morning, was really shocked. And she said, I saw it on Facebook. And I thought, goodness, you know, and I wasn't really on Facebook in those days. And I thought, well, that's a strange platform. But that's it is what you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, you can go to the BBC for the inverted commas official, you know, story, or you can see what the people that you trust, your friends, your colleagues, your family are saying.
Yeah.
So for her, she wasn't interested in what Laura Koonsberg or Nick Robinson or the BBC correspondents were saying. She was far more interested in what, you know, the effect that it's having on family members. And, you know, it may affect her way of life family in America, etc. So I think that's also changed very much. The idea that the whole family would all sit round, as I did, I remember sitting with my dad, you know, we'd all watch the 6 o'clock news every evening to see what was happening in news, was these days, of course, well, I carry it around on my phone, so I don't, you know, I never sit in front of the television. I don't need to, but that's a massive change, certainly in what 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, if you compare this to, let's say, 10 years ago? Is it 10 years ago? No, blimey, I don't know when. You know, when the Twin Towers were attacked in
America. That's
right, 2001,
so 18,
18 years ago. It's a long time ago. I mean, everybody remembers where they were. Yeah. Everyone remembers what they were doing, found out.
Actually, I was in Lampeter.
I'm thinking of when I found out about, again, the death of Princess of Wales.
Yeah.
I was in Lampeter. Yeah. I got a call from America. Yeah. I mean, I was in Lampeter. You don't get that these days. You find out about it online on your newsfeed. Yeah. You don't find out about it in a place. Yeah. You find out about it in a community. And that's a very different way.
No, and actually, you've just said that's really that's all come back to me. Remember Nick Smith?
Yeah,
I remember living in the same house as him, and I said, it was early on the Sunday morning, I said, you know, Princess Diana has died, because he thought I was joking. It's like, well, you know, that you know, where has that come from? And of course, he then, as did other people in the course of the day, went upstairs to watch the news. I remember Martin Lewis, who actually got upset, he broke down in tears because he was reading this story. It was all like, you know, we haven't come to terms with this yet. And that was, what, the very end of August 97. But that was, again, extraordinary. But then, if we wanted to know it, we all sat round the television box.
Absolutely. Well, here's an interesting thing. Finding out about the Twin Towers, and you say, you'd thought when Nick Smith told you about Princess Diana that it was a joke.
Mm.
Finding out about the Twin Towers, I thought it was a joke. Now, interestingly enough, this makes me sound like a really sad man who can't leave who can't leave Lambeth. But I was staying in Nottingham in the house of a friend of mine from Lambeth, a guy called Dave Alger. And staying with me at the time, he was out at work, and staying with me at the time was a young woman who became the mother of my son, from Lambeth, that I'd met in Lambeth, a girl called Karen Tracy. And I found out about the Twin Towers getting a phone call from Finland from a friend of mine called Damon Tringham.
Yeah.
And so, if even though we were nowhere near Lambeth, I was surrounded by sort of this girl I'd met in Lambeth. Mm. I was staying in the house of a guy I was great friends with from Lambeth, and I got a call from Finland from a friend of mine from Lambeth. And so, still these connections, still connected to the news. But
And it's also funny, we just this very morning, that game of, is it it 3 or 4 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but how you can link one person to another. And it came up because one of my colleagues who's not an academic knows an academic in Leeds who's friends with somebody I interviewed yesterday when I was in Chester, and suddenly it was sort of like, oh, everybody knew each other.
Yeah.
And now suddenly it's almost as though we realise that there's this huge network, and we know at least one of everyone's friends.
Yeah.
To the point that we're now like, we've never met, but clearly, you know, we know and trust each other because we're obviously, yeah, we all have these mutual friends who are like fabulous people.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, that was one of the interesting things about going to the Lambda reunion last year, that even though I didn't know somebody, I knew somebody that she knew. Yeah. And that was nice.
Yeah. And what about things like, I mean, for me, listening to the radio, that was in those days in Lampeter. Mm. If I wanted to know, I mean, yes, of course, that we'd sit around the pool table or, you know, the refectory lounge and watch the 1 o'clock news, whatever it might
yeah,
be.
Yeah.
But also, for me, the radio was not just a source of information, but in terms of music, I did so much, you know, it was the background to my essay writing. So even to this day, when I'm teaching, sometimes I think, well, I'm teaching now what I myself studied in 1992, and then I remember it was 1992 because ... and it was particular.
I used to go for my background essay writing music. There was a shop in Cardiff, a record shop, and they did a deal where you could buy like a packet of unknown CDs, like 5 unknown CD singles in a brown paper bag, and you didn't know what they were, and you'd buy them for a fiver, and you'd get them back. And there was always one you really loved, a couple you hated, and a couple that were interesting and you benefited from. I cannot remember the name of that record store.
Well, the Spillers, was it?
Spillers, that's the one. Yeah. Spillers Records in Cardiff. And I used to go to Spillers Records whenever I was in Cardiff and come back with a haul of CDs that I'd never heard of in my life.
Yeah, and that's interesting because for me, I'd hear something on the radio. This is going back, more when I was very young. I hear it on the radio. Then I'd have to make that pilgrimage with my pocket money, and I mean, these are the days when records were 79p from Woolworths, so he seemed a princely sum in those days. You'd have to save up for it, but going down to Tesco, could have been Tesco's, but good to Woolworths or Later Years Our Price or HMV, and in the same way, you also knew that in buying that record, you were possibly contributing to it becoming number one.
Yeah, that's really important. Yeah. These days, we're not interested in the charts because there doesn't seem to be that connection between paying for a download or watching something on YouTube or whatever you do with songs these days. And it getting high in the charts. And actually, who cares about what the charts are? Because there are so many different charts. Yeah. And there is no equivalent to Top of the Pops. Now, I know that sounds like a really old man-y thing to say, but Top of the Pops was such an important program for the music lover because it was the gold standard. If you were on Top of the Pops, you'd made it.
Absolutely. And that's why even now when Top of the Pops 2, all the reruns are shown, then you can remember first time they were on Top of the Pops. Yep. And of course, there were those famous, like, is it The Clash, who never went on Top of the Pops? That was on principle. Mm. But also, that's legendary because they didn't go on, but they would have been invited.
Yeah, Clash.
Or those, was it the Boomtown Rats who wanted to sing? They wanted to perform live, but they had to sing along. And they sort of took the mickey out of that a little bit through their performance by putting up signs that, or they deliberately didn't sing in.
I remember Alexis Sale singing, "Hello, John, got a new motor," and just dancing around like a lunatic, got tired, and just started chatting to the audience while the record played. And that was, I mean, in terms of records, in terms of radio, you asked, I only started listening to radio in my last few years there. I made a conscious decision not to have a TV or a radio when I was... Yeah. When I first moved to Lambda, because I wanted it to be a social event. And I didn't want to sit alone listening to the radio or watching TV. I always wanted to be with friends. Yeah. By the time I got to my last couple of years, then, I was a research student. I wasn't quite so sociable. I mean, I was still sociable, but not quite so sociable. And I could sit at home listening to Mark and Lard.
Yeah.
Which was just phenomenal. It was amazing. This is when Britpop was huge, and listening to these guys at that explosion of music with Blur and Oasis slugging it out, I'm struggling to remember the others, but they were Dodgy
But it was seismic. It was Mark and Lard. I remember even John Peel was saying, because obviously Mark, from Manchester. Peel was from Liverpool, but Peel was really surprised when Mark and Lard were given The Breakfast Show after Chris Evans left, because he said, at the end of the day, they're indie presenters, and The Breakfast Show isn't that sort of format. Mm. But for a period, it looked like suddenly the indie scene had really gone mainstream, and that felt really different. Something had changed.
That
period,
and I think it was the BBC was conscious of that. I mean, you remember that period when It wasn't quite true, but when Status Quo were banned from Radio 1, you know, they tried suing Radio 1. You know, and I think that was a deliberate conscious shift of the BBC towards being a younger, more sort of more accessible site channel, rather than really all these old sort of 50-year-old DJs sort of playing Pick of the Pops, and stuff, which is what we now love.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because Radio 1's collapsed into whatever it is. I don't know what Radio 1 is now.
Yeah. I don't even have on my car, there's a button number 1, and nothing's set up for that. But Radio 2 is on 2, and bizarrely Radio 4 is on 3, but they're the only ones I will listen to.
Yeah.
But it's funny what you say about that, because, of course, all the jokes about, it's going down the chart. But you're right, they wanted to sue. But of course, this was something very symptomatic about the presenters, because by the time Johnny Beerling left as controller in the 90s, it was a bit like when Margaret Thatcher left Downing Street. The people who were around her were no longer the same people who were there earlier on. But there were these vestiges of radio presenters past who were really like, ooh, Gary Davis, and who's now on big on Radio 2 again. But Bruno Brooks, but also the Fluff Freeman. And it's really interesting. David Travis, who almost lost at the end of that era. But it was interesting that by that time they were so out of place that a decade earlier they were, some of them had been there from the very beginning of Radio 1. But something had changed, and it's almost as though these presenters now, the days when Mike Reed would ban or say, this record shouldn't be played, Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Do you think 10 years later people would be thinking, Mike Reed doesn't think that this is we're playing, well, we better, still went to number one.
We better listen to it.
Yeah, yeah.
The other side of that, I remember as a 15-year-old boy, and there was art class at school, at Archbishop Holgate's. There was art class, and the arts teacher used to have the radio on, and we happened to have arts class at the same time as, I think it was Simon Bates did this segment called Our Song.
That's right.
And there was this sort of music in the background, and he'd read this heartbreaking story. Now, I'd never heard Our Song before. Yeah. I listened to it, and because I'd never heard this kind of thing, I thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
I was laughing my head off at this clearly sort of massively tragic story played over this rather comically sad music. And I thought it was some form of Monty Python humour.
Yeah.
And no one could understand why I was creased up with laughing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Creased up with laughter over somebody's husband leaving them and the cat dying. And to me, this is the height of comedy. And I think, that showed that young people weren't connected with what was going on Radio 1. And things had to change.
Yeah. Yeah, and you'd find at that time as well that people, Radio 1 each year, would have this poll to see, everyone would vote, all the listeners would vote for their favourite song of all time.
Yeah.
And so you'd sort of, well into the 90s they were doing this, and John Miles and Music would sort of appear right at the top. And it was sort of, and you could see some of these, and they'd pair someone like Bruno Brooks with one of the younger female presenters to show that they were really sort of, cutting edge. And it just really felt somehow... that 10 years earlier that would have worked a treat, but something had changed, and you're right, Radio 2 kind of like took on that baton. A few more philosophically based questions just to sort of round off. And of course we didn't mention that, of course, your degree was in
my undergraduate degree was the 4-year pure philosophy. Master's degree was philosophy with Ozzie Hanfling. I don't know any philosophers who are listening to this, but Oswald Hanfling was quite well known in the field. He kind of came to Lambeter to sort of retire. He was put out to grass in the sort of 99 sort of period. And I'm back at university now, the University of York, studying for my doctorate in philosophy, because it never leaves you. Yeah. I remember, Rockingham Gill, Rocky, he was a massive influence on me. A lot of people loathed him.
Yeah.
I loved him. He was very Marmite in that respect. Yeah.
And looking back, they're not necessarily just your Lampeter days, but generally, would you say that your memories are predominantly positive?
I'm a positive kind of person, so I tend to choose the positive memories. I mean, where something is bittersweet, you choose the sweet over the bitter, don't you? There are periods of my life, I look back on school days and they were horrendous. I hated school. It turns out I'm dyslexic, which wasn't recognised until some of my Lambeter friends who were also dyslexic pointed it out to me, and I got myself tested and just as I was handing in my master's degree. And it explained why I was the bottom of the class at everything growing up through school, and why all the teachers told me I was stupid, why they told me I was lazy. And even people at university were telling me I just was lazy, I wasn't doing the reading. My you know, I wasn't trying hard enough, that kind of thing. And so school days were awful. I loathed them. I can still take positive memories out of that. Mm. Lampeter, my memories are almost universally positive. It was an explosion of me. And I was very much carpeing the diem, if you see what I mean. Yeah. School days, not so much.
No, but because there is that related question, isn't there, about whether negative experiences are ones that we can be nostalgic about.
Absolutely,
I think there's something about the challenges there. Mm. But also, you see, that's the thing, and that's the great thing about hindsight, is that you know how, well, not necessarily how the story ended, but you know how some of the little stories ended. Mm. And you can say, well, it turned out all right in the end, didn't it?
Well, even then, I mean, even where it may have turned out all right, it may not. I was talking to somebody about happiness once and saying that happiness isn't always about smiling. So I look back on certain periods of Lampeter and they were very happy. But there were periods of deep sadness, deep misery, deep frustration there. And I look back on those periods with fondness, nostalgically. There was a period where, you know, a guy called Charles Marriott and Joe Davey and I would get horribly drunk because we were all really depressed about stuff. And you know, we'd listen to Amy Mann on the CD player and Squeeze. I remember we were really into these bands. Yeah. And I look at those periods of sadness, actually, with very positive nostalgic memories. So yeah, I think that you can be happy about this.
And do you think your 5 or your 15-year-old self would recognise what you're doing now? Question about whether you've fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young. What do you think your 15-year-old self would think about what you're doing now?
I actually think about this all the time. There is that moment when we all sit down and think, you know, where did it all go wrong? Yeah. I mean that in a jokey sense, but when you're young, you kind of have this idea of what life should be because of your parents. And okay, my parents split when I was about 10, and so that might have changed, but I still had this idea of working in an office and having a 9-to-5 job and a car and a semi-detached house and a couple of kids. And my life is so very different from that. And I would not, my 15-year-old self wouldn't recognise me now. For very positive reasons.
Yeah.
I think I'd like to think I'd be quite impressed with what I did with my life.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't an awful lot in front of me when I was about 15.
Yeah. It's like that scene in The Shawshank Redemption, isn't it? When Morgan Freeman's character is asked, you know, what would you say to them? He himself offers that reflection when he's, you know, being up for parole for the millionth time, and he's so sure he's not going to get it. He speaks the truth, and then suddenly, it's been accepted. But that's the interesting thing, isn't it? If you could go back and talk to your 15-year-old self, you know, what sort of advice would you give him?
I suppose the first piece of advice is I'd say choose your path. So it's very easy. It's a 15-year-old. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And if you have an idea of where you want to go, then you can go for it. I chose my path after a series of unfortunate choices forced me into a particular life path. I mean, these choices were, as I was leaving Lampeter, I was persuaded through various reasons to become a teacher of English as a foreign language because there's a lot of respect in that and there's a lot of money in that. Well, there's no respect in it and there's no money in it. And once you're in that path, it's difficult to get out of it. And so I found that my life choices were then all about grabbing experiences and finding great new things to do. Yeah. Had I made certain choices earlier, I might have chosen to work for a bank or a more stable life and have that kind of 9-to-5 job that I'd always wanted. Yeah. But I think it was quite late for me to have an idea of which path I wanted. Partly because I went to university. I was nearly 23 when I went to university. I was about 30 when I left university. And so, you know, I was a late starter anyway. But I think if I'd had an idea of what I wanted, then I could have gone for it a lot earlier than I did.
Yeah. And my very, very last question, would you consider yourself, Martin, to be a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't see them that differently. I have what you might call it a synchronic view of time. I don't see looking back and looking forward as massively different. And so, I see myself enjoying the present being propelled by the past into a future that is just absolutely wonderful, whatever the hell it's going to be. And so, yeah, I don't make a big
difference. No, and I see them as two sides of the same coin. Actually, yeah. One person I interviewed actually said, what a ridiculous question. and I thought, I said it was the last question. And then half an hour later, I got very defensive. It was the best bit of the interview. Because I was like, well, let me explain why I asked that. Yeah. You didn't have to choose one or the other.
It's certainly not a ridiculous question, but it's a great question because it brings up how you view time. Yeah. And you know, I mean, some people, they view time in this sort of linear sort of one, then the other sort of way. But if you don't view time like that, if you have this more sort of polychronic view of time, then you can sort of sit back and go, okay, right, let's think what we mean by that.
Absolutely. Well, I'm definitely not going to say, Martin, thank you for your time. Oh, I just did. Martin, it's so brilliant to catch up. Thank you.
It's absolutely brilliant. Thanks very much, Chris. Appreciate it.